MacCast, Tuesday, September 11th, 2012. Hey, MacGeeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for MacGeeks by MacGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, it is iPhone 5 week, or new iPhone week, whatever it's going to be called. It's looking, by the invitations that actually went out last week, that it is going to be the 5. The invite showed an event scheduled for the 12th that had the number 12 on it, and then in the shadow of the 12 was a number 5. It was actually very subtle, very nicely done on the invite for Apple. But regardless, everybody's going to be gathering at the Yerba Buena Center tomorrow, and Apple will be announcing something. Most of us do think it's going to be the new iPhone along with iOS 6 and possibly some iPod announcements. We're going to get into that in this episode along with a bunch of other great stuff. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. If you're actually considering buying one of those new iPhones as an upgrade and you want to use your current phone to help cover maybe some of the costs of that new device, Gazelle is a perfect way to do that. Gazelle gives you cash for your old device, and they make the process super easy. If you go to gazelle.com right now, you can select your device, the carrier, and answer a quick question about the condition, and instantly on screen, they're going to give you an offer. They're going to show you a price, show you how much that device is worth today. And the best part of this is you can lock that offer in for 30 days. So you can go there now, find out what your device is worth, and lock that price in. And then when the new device comes out, go pick up the new device and then send in your old one to Gazelle, and they'll even pay for the shipping. So they make the whole process really simple. Once they receive it, they process it quickly, and then you get paid. You get cash. You can get paid by check, by PayPal. And it couldn't be easier. You don't have to deal with hassles of private sales and auction sites and all that stuff. So check it out. Go lock your price in now. It's quick and easy, and the values are likely to go down as time goes on. So don't wait any longer. Gazelle.com, G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So as I was saying, we are literally less than 24 hours away from the announcement of the new iPhone. It's going to happen tomorrow, the 12th of September at 10 a.m. Pacific time, Pacific Daylight Time in San Francisco at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. Apple does a lot of their announcements there. Everybody's been prepping. The venue's been prepped. I'm sure media is all on their way there right now. And we will know exactly what Apple has to show us in just a few hours. But as far as what is being predicted, I guess I need to back up a little bit. With those decorations, there's already that wild speculation that always happens, right? The banners started going up, and one of the banners features an Apple logo with this sort of streaked colored background, this rainbow colored background. Actually, kind of was a little bit reminiscent in my mind of the old Apple logo, but a bunch of sites were doing analysis looking at the pictures, and some of them are alluding to the fact that because it looks like what Apple did was take the app icons that are Apple's default icons on iOS and sort of stretched and blurred them to create this kind of background. And they're saying, well, that hints at the fact that the new iPhone screen is going to be a 4-inch taller, more stretched screen. So you can read anything you want into tea leaves and kind of make a case for something like that. So I find those things kind of funny, but it's out there nonetheless. They were saying it. Really, on the hardware front, there's not a lot new in terms of the prediction side of things. You know, I don't know how you feel about it, but it seems like the surprise has been a little bit spoiled. But this has always happened. I mean, the last few announcements, we sort of know a lot of the things that are going to be in the final device. A lot of them come true, some of them don't. And it just seems more and more these days that the leaks get more feverish and more accurate as time goes on. I don't know. But I'm still excited about it. It doesn't take away any of the excitement for me. It is going to be supposedly a taller screen, 4 inches, not any wider. So pixel dimensions, 1136 by 640. Everybody's expecting them to bump the RAM up, finally doubling it from the 512 that it has been up to 1 gigabyte. That's going to bring it more in line, I think, with some of the Android devices that are out there. A better processor. There is some debate on which processor Apple might go with. Some sites are predicting it will be a modified dual-core A5X, like is in the new iPad, or potentially a brand-new quad-core A6. I think most of us are hoping for that quad-core, but I think power is going to have a lot to do with whether or not they get that processor in there, and performance, and obviously probably production yields factor in there as well. On the SIM side, the nano SIM is looking more and more like it is going to be the new standard for Apple's phones going forward. It was a standard that Apple actually helped develop, and we saw some images from 9 to 5 Mac late this week showing that Vodafone already has nano SIMs ready to go, supposedly like 500,000 of them, 500,000 of them ready to go. And that also is an interesting little indicator, because it could indicate that Apple is planning a multi-country release day, a simultaneous release across multiple countries. Reading a little bit into that, but that would be something, I think it's been something they've been working toward for a while. We saw the new iPad have a multi-country release date, and this would be, I believe, the first phone that would have a simultaneous multi-country rollout. But that could be good news for those of you outside the U.S., and we'll have to wait and see which countries they're going to roll in. But it sounds like Germany might be one of those, along with the U.S. and Canada. Also, possibly Asia and other parts of Europe are being rumored. So, let's see. The new processor, nano SIM, smaller 9-pin dock connector. That's the new dock connector we've been seeing pictures of. Actually, looks about the same size as a mini USB port. The cable I kind of really like. I like the style of it. It looks like it's going to be simple and easy to use. There were rumors this week that the dock adapters are also going to be relatively affordable. If this turns out to be accurate, they're saying $10 for the adapter for your old devices, and that you'll be able to get those directly from Apple. I would assume they're going to have those available on the same day that they launch the device. 4G LTE support, Wall Street Journal is reporting that that would be supported in Europe and Asia, which is, again, more good news on the international front. There had been those issues with the new iPads where the 4G wasn't supported in all countries and in regions. It sounds like this is going to be broader support on the 4G LTE side. Interestingly, the Wall Street Journal report cited Europe, Asia, and the U.S. They didn't mention anything about Canada, but typically Canada is also supported along with the U.S. when they roll these things out. So I would think that those of you up north are going to be just fine with the LTE support. Headphone jack on the bottom, along with that new dock connector. Also, the two-tone metal and glass back design. I'm still up in the air how that's actually going to look live and in person. I've seen images online where I like the look of it, and I've seen other ones where it's just glaringly obvious and doesn't look all that elegant to me, doesn't look seamless. But some of the images of the black version with the metal back, if it's got more of a dark gray black tone to it, not such a light metal color, it looks like it actually might look pretty nice. So I'm going to hold judgment until I actually see the true actual device. It'll be interesting to see how it looks when Apple's up there presenting it on stage. Actual launch day, as far as when everybody's expecting them to start going on sale, iMore is predicting the 21st, which is just about a little more than a week later, a week from the Friday after the announcement date on the 12th. Best Buy is reportedly already getting some display materials for the launch. Those materials were dated from the images I saw as 9/18/2012 to 10/27/2012. So Friday does seem like it could be a logical release day. I don't think they're going to push it forward to the 18th, which I believe is like a Tuesday or something like that. Typically, Apple releases the iPhone on Fridays. So I would buy the 21st as the logical date for the release. Once it is released, it's expected to be a huge seller. I don't know if that comes as a surprise to anyone, but a JP Morgan analyst this week came out and said it could be so big that it might even raise the US GDP. To be fair, he said his prediction was based on some pretty aggressive numbers, really an overestimate of possible sales. He's predicting that Apple could sell 8 million iPhones in the fourth quarter, and at an average selling price of about $600, he thinks that would result in annualized GDP growth of $3.2 billion, which according to his estimates would be a 0.33 percentage point boost. So Apple becoming quite an economic powerhouse, I guess, with their product releases, just the sheer numbers of these things that they're going to sell and could potentially sell can have significant impact on the economy. And I think if you look at Apple's stock price and how that's gone up over the last few years, you see another big piece of evidence surrounding that. 9 to 5 Mac also claims that the launch will include a bunch of new iPod announcements. And that makes a lot of sense because historically, this September announcement has been the timing for Apple to announce new iPods. 9 to 5 is predicting 3 updates to the various models in the line. iPod Shuffles would be new. They're really not giving a lot of details. They don't know about capacity. I don't know if capacity would go up. They're saying at least 3 new colors. Adding that to the 5 existing colors, there'd be a total of 8 colors on the iPod Shuffle. iPod Nano, they're also predicting an update for, again, coming out in more colors, the same 8 I would assume that the iPod Shuffle is going to have. They did not give any details about this, but I had heard other rumors that the new Nano would move back to the taller style design, so more like the generation before the current generation in terms of shape. As far as what it's going to look like, it would be mostly screen, possibly having a physical home button at the bottom, so looking a little bit more like an iPod Touch. And then new iPod Touches, probably the biggest updates are going to come to that lineup. One interesting thing that came out this week is that Apple may hold on to the current design and lower the price on that to give you an entry-level iPod Touch, similar to the way they've done with the iPhones over the last few years. So you have that kind of entry point model, and then you have the newer models that people can take advantage of. On the 2 new models, the pricing would be $299 and $399. There was no word on whether or not we'd see capacity bumps in that range, but I think that would be nice. A lot of people, especially on the high end, I think would like to see 128 gigabyte model. I'm not sure that would happen, but that would be awesome if it did. As far as the form factor, it's sounding like it's going to match the new iPhones, a taller 4-inch screen, possibly a Retina display, the upgrade to the new dock connector. So that'll become universal, I think, across all of Apple's products. Actually, it'll be interesting. They didn't mention this in the article, but I'm just thinking about this now. If they're going to do a new Nano and a Shuffle, I think Apple would go to that new dock connector across the line. Well, the Shuffle still has that old style headphone jack connector, but on the Nano, at least, the new 9-pin docking connector would seem likely, and they'd do that across the board. And again, on the iPod Touch, 9 to 5 seems to think that they'll be coming out with different colors. They didn't say if there'd be the same 8 colors on the iPod Touch, but if they did go that route, that'd be another interesting change because, you know, that can cause inventory problems for Apple. Doing all those different colors, certain ones become popular and it's hard to predict which ones are going to be popular, which ones are going to be the better sellers, and Apple kind of has to stock them all at their various retail locations. So it does cause some inventory hassles. So it'd be interesting to understand why they would want to go with a bunch of new colors. But regardless, we're going to know very, very soon whether or not we've got new colors on all of these iPods, and also all the details about what the new iPhone 5 is going to feature. And a lot of people aren't talking about this, but I'm even, I think, a little bit more excited about iOS 6. iOS 6 will be coming along, I'm sure, with the new iPhone, and that is going to be an upgrade available to a bunch of us. So great new features, the new maps in iOS 6, the new Siri features, bunch of stuff that I'm very excited about, Passbook and other kinds of things. And I'm sure we're going to get a lot more details at the announcement about what features and functionality are in iOS 6 and maybe get some more cool demos about how all that stuff is going to work and integrate. So however you look at it, it's going to be an exciting week this week. And I will be back toward the end of the week with all of the results and coverage about everything that was announced. I think by all accounts, the Mountain Lion release, the latest version of Mac OS X, Mac OS 10.8, was probably one of the smoothest releases that I remember hearing about in recent history. I got very few reports from you, from anybody in the community, about issues with the update. Those people who were eligible to upgrade seemed to have a pretty easy time of it. It's pretty much a straight over-the-top install process for most users. I think we've talked about that a little bit on the show. About the only complaint that happened after release was there were a number of people reporting reduced battery life on Apple laptops, on notebooks. And Ars Technica and a couple different places did some initial testing and kind of confirmed that 10.8 did result for a lot of people in a significant drop in battery life. The Mac Observer also did some pretty extensive testing. And I think across the board, what they discovered was you could see battery life losses with the update of about 33% of your usage time. So definitely a significant drop. There was no real consensus on specifically why it was happening or what was going on, but luckily it is believed or was believed to be a software issue. And so TMO, the Mac Observer, came back and Jim Tanis over there did some extensive testing and confirmed the initial findings, but also showed that yes, 10.8.1 did improve things slightly, and I think that was verified by a couple different sources, but they've also now discovered that 10.8.2, the beta builds, are looking very promising as potentially fixing these problems. So over at the Mac Observer, to do their tests, they used a 2011 15-inch MacBook Pro running at 2 gigahertz with 8 gigabytes of RAM and an SD and or an SSD drive and a traditional spindle-based hard drive. And they tried the testing, the battery life testing on both models. They spent a lot of time doing this, and they tested multiple operating systems, moving from 10.6.8, running each incremental update all the way up through 10.8.2, taking test points and measurements at each stage of the different builds. And they were using the 12C35 build, which I think was the prior build of 10.8.2 beta right before the latest one that was just released. And they did find that if you're running Lion, you want to be running 10.7.4. It performed almost as well as 10.6.8 in terms of battery life. So if you're running Snow Leopard and you can't go up to Mountain Lion, you want to get to Lion, the best version for battery life seems to be 10.7.4. On Mountain Lion, like I said, they 10.8 decreased battery life significantly. On their test model, they saw an hour and 45 minutes less battery life after installing the 10.8 update. That was about 30% battery loss. When they ran the 10.8.1 update, it did improve things, but it was still an hour and 15 minutes less battery life than they were getting under 10.7.4. The big news, though, in their findings was that early tests showed the 10.8.2 build ran actually better than the 10.7.4 levels. So it should bring, when Apple releases that, your battery life back up into normal levels. They did caution in their piece, and I think this is well put, that the 10.8.2 build that they're using is a developer build, and Apple can always tweak things before the final release. So hopefully they won't do anything to screw up the battery life improvements. I don't suspect that they would, but early indicators seem to look very positive. So if you haven't upgraded to 10.8 because of some of the battery life reports, it sounds like when 8.2 comes out, you should be able to upgrade. I would watch the feeds, listen to the MacCast, and pay attention. I'm sure everybody's going to be testing the new final build once it's released, but I would expect that that's getting pretty close to release and should be out relatively soon. As we move toward the end of the year, you know, things for the PC industry, at least in the US, but I think actually across the board, are looking pretty grim. Sales numbers are not doing well as a whole. But Apple seems to be bucking the trend, and they seem to be keeping their head above water and actually doing quite well moving in toward the end of the year. NPD released their latest numbers for U.S. domestic PC sales, and things do not look good on a whole. Gene Munster, though, says Apple is going to be doing just fine. The NPD numbers show that U.S. PC sales are down 7% in the first 2 months of the last quarter of the year, but checks by Gene Munster show that Apple is actually beating that trend. Munster estimates that Apple's year-over-year sales are up 5% for the September quarter, and tracking those numbers out, he predicts that would result in sales of about 5.1 million Macs for Apple in the September quarter. That would beat their prior September quarter sales record of 4.9 million Macs, which came last year. Apple is also being rumored to have some nice fall Mac updates coming. The biggest one probably being the 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro we've been hearing about. There's also predictions that Apple might have some new iMacs in the mix, and those two models could keep their sales up as they move toward the holiday season, toward the end of the year, and let them continue to stay ahead of that PC downward sales trend. As for when we'll actually see those new Macs, Digitimes is claiming that the 13-inch Retina MacBook Pros are slated and ready to go for October. We're getting some rumors that there's already shipments in the works, so that announcement might be coming in the next couple weeks. It could be just a soft launch on Apple's website. I don't know if they're going to put out a big announcement or if they'll maybe mention it at one of these events that they're holding, because we are still predicting that in October, Apple's going to have that next iPad announcement, probably announcing the iPad mini. So they could, I guess, mention new MacBook Pros or new Mac models there, but it's really suspected that that is going to be a focus on just the iPad. So Apple will typically rev or update models sort of in the background along with everything. So be watching Apple's website to see if that happens. On the iMac front, DigiTimes was reporting that there are delays in the iMacs because of screen issues. Getting screens and yields from suppliers being relatively low seem to be a problem for Apple, at least according to them. There are reports from other sources, though, that say iMacs are due to arrive very soon. New 21-inch and 27-inch models. I think Clayton Morris over at Fox had come out and said his sources are showing that new models are coming very soon. Actually, imminent was, I think, how he had mentioned it in his tweet. And he said he hadn't heard anything specifically about Retina displays, but that the new display resolutions are very high. It's also expected that the new iMac models would update to the latest Ivy Bridge processors, include USB 3, and offer bigger SSD options. So if you've been in the market for a new Mac desktop, you might want to hold off for another couple weeks and see what Apple has up their sleeve. And with that, that's going to do it for the news for early this week. Stay tuned, because later in the week, of course, we're going to have the results of all of these announcements. We're going to cover all the details and nitty-gritty on Apple's new lineup of products, new iPhones and iPod Touches. And then I'm sure there's going to be more information about the next pending announcements and event coming through in the next week or so. So stay tuned for all of that. I want to start off the feedback portion of today's episode with some feedback from Matt. I had actually covered on the last show, somebody had asked about using PhotoStream when you don't have iPhoto or Aperture installed on your Mac. And is it possible? Can I use it with a different application? Can I get access to those photos if I've enabled PhotoStream through iCloud? And I had done some digging in, and from what I found, it seemed like it was going to be possible. I looked in my library folder. There's actually a folder on your Mac where those PhotoStream photos are stored once you've enabled the feature through iCloud in the system preferences. And while the folder structure in there is a little bit cryptic in terms of the naming, all of the images are in there, the JPEGs, and you can get at them either through navigating through that forest, that sort of cryptic structure, or I thought better yet, you could use an Automator script or maybe even a smart folder to extract that information, put it somewhere more convenient, like on your desktop or in your home folder, and get at those photos. And then, of course, once you have access to the photos, you should be able to move them into whatever application you'd like. Now, you won't be able to keep them in sync because you can't do upstream into the photo stream without iPhoto or Aperture, but it definitely seemed possible to enable it on your iOS devices, enable it on your Mac, and actually get access to those images from your Mac. Unfortunately, I was testing, all of my Macs already have iPhoto on them, and Matt sent me a great follow-up email where he had tried this on a Mac that didn't have iPhoto or Aperture already installed on it. And when you go into the system preferences on a machine like that and look in iCloud, the PhotoStream icon is actually grayed out, and you can't even check the checkbox to enable the feature. As a matter of fact, I think the text in there says it requires iPhoto or Aperture to be able to be turned on, and there's like a Learn More button that goes to an Apple Tech Info article. So you do, it sounds like, need iPhoto or Aperture installed to be able to enable the PhotoStream feature. And then once you do that, those documents are stored in your home folder, in the library folder, inside the application support folder. There's an iLife asset management folder. And inside that is where you'll find the folders and subfolders with your actual PhotoStream images. So you might have to actually install iPhoto to be able to get access to those images. But this particular listener just wanted access to the images so that he could then use them in Lightroom and not have to use them with iPhoto or Aperture. So maybe the workaround is to go ahead, buy iPhoto, install it, enable the photo stream, and then use the tricks that I covered in the last show to actually get access to the photos and use them with a different application. So not ideal, but a little more details and specifics on how this stuff works. If anybody does know, I guess the follow-up question to that would be, if anybody does know a way to trick OS X or iCloud to enable PhotoStream without actually having iPhoto or Aperture installed, if it's possible, that would be a cool follow-up tip as well. But I haven't found any information indicating that you could actually do that. And thanks, Matt, for sending in the follow-up email, because, again, I didn't have a system without iPhoto that I could really test on. I also want to follow up on some of the patent stuff we've been talking about, specifically related to the settlement between... settlement. It's not really a settlement, is it? I was going to say the settlement between Apple and Samsung. Really, the results, the findings, the ruling on the Apple v. Samsung case. Gosh, I got to get my terminology right. I'm really not good at this legal stuff. But I wanted to follow up and clarify some things related to statements that I made about that. I think I may have caused a little bit of confusion, especially on the last show when I gave the commentary on my thoughts regarding technology patents in general in light of the whole Apple versus Samsung case. Listener Kim sent me an email pointing out that, you know, the Apple patents in question, specifically with respect to the iPad, were not held up by the jury in the case. And I think I mentioned that in the initial piece when I kind of gave the news. But then in my follow-up, I was talking about the fact that I personally don't feel anybody should be able to patent rounded rectangles. And this is one of the arguments that Samsung made in the case, was that in essence, with some of these design patents, Apple has a patent on rounded rectangles. And there was one patent in particular, the D889 patent, which covers the iPad and the shape and form factor of the iPad. And that specific patent was not upheld by the jury. Samsung was not found to be infringing with their Galaxy Tab on that patent. And there was a similar one for the iPhone, the D087 patent, which also covered sort of the shape and the form factor of the iPhone. And in that case, I think there were 13 potential cases of infringement that Apple was alleging, and only in five of those cases was Samsung found to be infringing. So on another 8, they were cleared. And once again, those would be what most people are referring to when you hear us talking about it in the news as the rounded corner or rounded rectangle patents. So just to clarify, Apple still did kind of get coverage and protection for the shape with respect to smartphones. They did not get protection in this case for devices, tablet-based devices. Samsung was not found to be infringing. But the ultimate point that I was trying to make, I think, still really stands. It's the essence of those two patents and sort of the broadness that I'm taking issue with. And this is, once again, to be very clear, this is not an Apple issue or problem. This is not a Samsung problem. This is an overall problem, I think, with the patent law and sort of how it's being applied and how patents are being issued. I understand the process is to protect competition. It's to allow someone to innovate and design something without the fear that someone's going to come along and steal their ideas. But when you start to get too broad, and specifically what I think calls into question is the issue of what's called prior art. And again, I am not a patent expert, so everything I'm sharing with you here is just my opinion. It's thoughts on reading stuff. This is not fact. This is not news. I'd need to get a lawyer on the show to get into the nitty-gritty detail. But I'm going to share with you, you know, sort of my understanding of this stuff and where I'm taking issue. And prior art is this idea that information that has been already made available to the public in any form before a given date may be that information may be relevant to a patent's claim of originality. Okay, so what does that mean? That basically means if the idea of a rounded rectangle tablet computing device has already been put out there in any form by anyone, then it can call into question the originality of the idea and also call into question, is this patentable? And Samsung had wanted to argue that there was prior art from the science fiction film 2001, A Space Odyssey, that depicted these tablet-style devices. Now, I think ultimately they weren't allowed to use that argument, but I think the idea still stands. You know, I had kind of said that Star Trek, in my mind, really has prior art for the iPad. I mean, this concept, Gene Roddenberry put forth this concept in his TV show that we have these pad things. They didn't look exactly like an iPad, but again, the idea seems to be existing and has existed for a long time. And you can use, it's been proven that you can use fictional and artistic representations of things as prior art. I found some information online that cited cases where that kind of content was used. Again, anything that existed, prior art is anything that was made available to the public and could call into question the originality of the idea. So did Apple really come up with this concept and this design and this form factor? And of course, again, you're going to have to get to lawyers and legal people and someone looking at this a lot more closely. But even without the prior art argument, I think you can see that the jury obviously found something in there and was smart enough to see that in that claim, that D889 claim, Apple wasn't able to prove that there was infringement on that part. And so that doesn't necessarily invalidate the patent, and that may be more of a problem than a solution, because Apple can still take that and they can still apply it. And I've looked at those patents, I've looked at the illustrations in both the iPhone one and in the iPad one, and it's a pretty generic looking device. So if those patents get teeth and Apple can use them, they can use that to block a lot of devices from coming to market just based on this form factor. And again, I don't know that form factor in my mind is completely original. I mean, we definitely had phones looking a lot different before iOS devices came out, and that's probably what Apple's looking at and saying. But I could also probably find a lot of examples in science fiction and pop culture that show things that look very much like Apple's iPhone. And so are those prior art? Does that invalidate the claims? Should Apple have never gotten those patents? Possibly. And that's all I'm saying. So again, my real issue is that these broad patents can be applied in ways that defeat the original intent of the patent system, which is to protect innovation and to encourage innovation. I really do worry about the little guy, especially in light because of these cases that are coming up. You have companies like Google and Apple and Amazon and Microsoft all building these giant patent portfolios. They're finding originators, people who created broad patents, buying up those patents, putting them in these big giant pools, and then putting lawyers behind them and lots of money to block other people from coming up with ideas. And if it's a truly original idea, it absolutely should be protected. Patent law should apply here. But if it's the concept that I have a flat tablet thing with a screen with round corners, and that's the extent of the patent, then that gets really scary to me. I'm sorry. It seems like the little guy that has an idea for a great product might not be able to bring it to market, might not be able to bring that idea forward without fear of getting sued to oblivion by some giant corporation. So I do worry about that, and I do question that, you know, is the patent office, do these patents need to be reevaluated? Again, just my opinion. You may or may not agree with me. And even if you do or don't, I would love to hear your thoughts in either direction. Send me an email, send me an audio comment, and we'll keep this conversation going. The last thing I do want to clarify, though, is some people have accused me of trying to imply that Apple is a patent troll or acting with patent trollish behavior. I am certainly not saying that. I'm saying that they're participating in a system that has been built up over the last few years that all other companies are participating in. And I think it's just the way you play the game right now. And what I'm really trying to say is I think the rules of the game need to change. I think we need to fix this thing, and we need to make it so that this isn't how a company has to behave to participate in the current environment. I think if Apple didn't have to play this game, they would happily not play it. They would prefer to be in the lab innovating, creating great ideas, and not having to worry about all this stuff and not having to participate in this kind of kind of stuff. It's just, no one likes it, I guess is what it's getting down to. I don't think anybody I've ever talked to about this topic says this is a good thing in any way. And so something needs to be done. I think we're coming to that head. And I'm very positive that this will happen because of these kinds of conversations that we're having. So send me your feedback, send me your emails, let me know what you think about this stuff. And I mean, come on, let's be honest. Is anybody being really fooled by these other devices that look very similar to an iPhone or an iPad? You know, we've had all these weird news reports and stories about things like people bringing Samsung tablets back to Best Buy thinking that they bought an iPad and they were confused. But I really think that's kind of an exception. I think most people know the differences between these devices and, you know, make their decisions based on other factors beyond just how the thing actually looks or the shape of it, something like that. So I think most people, when making buying decisions concerning these types of products, use other factors to figure out what they want and which device they're going to buy. And kind of related to that, I received this question from JP.
Hey, Adam, this is JP from Chicago. I just finished listening to your newest episode. And of course, with more rumors coming out about the iPhone 5 or the new iPhone, I literally couldn't be more excited. It did remind me, though, of something. A close friend of mine is currently in the market for a new cell phone. He got burned a while back during kind of the BlackBerry debacle, we'll call it. And what he's looking for now is really debating between getting the iPhone and looking at the Samsung Galaxy S3. Now, I don't know if you could help me provide even more information. Now, he's an engineer. He's a smart guy, and but everything, you know, I think he's a very, he's a thinker, and so he needs to kind of have all the facts coming into this. I've been doing my best to really pitch it to him, but I feel like he's starting to lean towards the dark side. He's leaning more towards Samsung. So, Adam, if you have any more advice just about some really great features that are still coming out on the iPhone, even for a first-time iPhone user, I'd love to hear them. Thanks again for everything you do, Adam. Really love listening to the show. Have a good one.
Hey, thanks, JP. That's a tough call. It's a really tough question, especially considering what you mentioned, that this guy is an engineer. He's a tech-savvy user. And when you go through the current iPhone 4S and the Galaxy S3, and you just go spec for spec, the Galaxy S3 has some nice features in it. It even has a slight edge, I think, on the iPhone in terms of things like processor speed and RAM. Screen size, not necessarily pixel density, but it is a larger screen. You've got a better front-facing camera and some other nice features. The ability to expand the storage is nice when you're a tech user and you know how to use an SD card. Those kinds of things add up and they do make a difference. But as you mentioned, the iPhone 5 is right on the cusp of being announced. We don't know specifically what's in there yet, but it should even things up on a lot of the spec fronts. So now we're back to kind of two devices that are very, very similar. The couple differences that are always going to be there and maybe give an advantage to a tech-savvy person on the Galaxy S3 side are things like HDMI out, although you can get that with the iPhone with an adapter, obviously, but having it built in is kind of nice. I already mentioned the SD slot and a more standardized mini USB. Apple's going to have their proprietary thing, and they've always kind of done that. At the end of the day, though, I think the battle then becomes really about experience. One piece of ammunition, just based on the reading I've done, I personally have not gone out and held a Galaxy S3, but I've seen a couple reports that HTC has a model, an Android model out right now that's pretty popular that I guess has a little bit better build quality than the S3, at least according to some of the reports I read. So I think there's no doubt that the iPhone and the iPhone 5 is going to be phenomenal in terms of the build quality. So you might be able to appeal to his engineering side with how the fit and finish on the iPhone is so nice. I mean, Apple's devices always have that, but you pay a little bit of a price premium for that as well. I think, though, on the feature side of things, iOS 6 is going to do a lot more to sell iPhones, and I think always has. I think the operating system has always sold the phone more than the hardware itself. The hardware is a bonus because it's beautiful and gorgeous and stuff like that, but really, it's how you use it. It's the apps that you can install on it. It's the things that it does that makes the difference in terms of the smartphone and the smartphone experience. So I don't know if your friend has already had experience with Android or iOS, or if he's only been a BlackBerry guy, either one of those upgrades are going to be phenomenal for him. But I think on the iOS 6 side, some things that you could point to maybe would be the Siri integration. It's getting more mature in iOS 6. I know that Android has Jelly Bean coming out, which has the Google, I think they call it Google Now, very similar Siri-style technology, but I don't think it's available right now on the Galaxy S3. Galaxy S3 is supposed to get its Jelly Bean upgrade very soon, might even be out by the time you hear this, so that might be a moot point, but you could maybe push him towards Siri and show him some of the cool stuff that's in there. Apple's maps in iOS 6, to me, look amazing. I know, again, Google has a similar 3D mapping technology, but I've looked at that on Google Earth, and I've compared that to some of the videos that you've seen online with what's going on with iOS 6 and its mapping, and the Apple maps look a lot better. There's a lot more detail. They're not as blurry and kind of wonky. So that's kind of nice, and Apple will finally have built-in turn-by-turn directions using TomTom and Waze technology under the hood. So that's going to bring it more in line with some of the stuff that you're seeing on the Android side of things. Probably the one killer feature that I don't think, and I'm sure someone's going to correct me if I get this wrong, but in the research that I was doing, I don't think Android currently has anything close to AirPlay technology, at least not integrated into the core operating system itself. And AirPlay to me, especially AirPlay mirroring, is an amazing technology in iOS 6 and available on Macs and with the Apple TVs and stuff like that. The one downside is that that relies on an integrated Apple ecosystem, right? So if all of your devices are Macs and iOS devices, then this integrates and works very well. If your friend is a PC owner, it may not be as much of a selling point, but I think AirPlay is amazing. And I know they have similar technologies on Android, but what I'm talking about is just the ease of use and the integration, and that goes to that experience that I'm talking about. You know, buying from the App Store is seamless. I haven't played around too much with the Google Play Store, installing apps, you know, from different locations and managing apps and stuff like that. Apple makes it all really easy. Now, I have an Android device, an older Android device, in an LG phone, the Optimus V or 5. I'm not sure if it's V or 5, but I have that phone, and in my opinion, the whole experience has always been a little bit clunky compared to iOS. You know, things like the back home and setting buttons that you have to use for navigation along with the touchscreen, and I know the newer devices have virtual versions of those buttons, but it's still extra, like, things that you have to click on, and it doesn't seem always intuitive to me which button I'm supposed to click. Now, I'm sure that's just a learning curve thing, and if I had been an Android user, if I was exclusively an Android user, I'd probably pick that stuff up pretty quickly, but it just wasn't out-of-the-box intuitive, and it was pretty out-of-the-box intuitive when I started using my iOS device. So that is a good argument. Generally, when you're talking to a less tech-savvy user, your friend can probably figure it out. I have a feeling another big factor that would go into his decision would be integration of just the device itself with his computing environment, with the other things that it needs to interact with. And once again, if you're an Apple user and a Mac is your main desktop computer, then integration with iPhone is just phenomenal. It's so easy and simple, you'd probably want to go with the iPhone. But if you're going to be relying for contacts and calendars and stuff like that on something like Google, which has great support on iOS, I would imagine the Google support on an Android device is even better, even more seamless and easier to use. So I tend to recommend to people stuff based on how they're going to use it, what kind of experience they want to have, and what other technologies they're integrating with. So as much as I wish everybody would just buy an iPhone and everybody would just buy a Mac, I also recognize that very often the right choice is something else for someone. So as much as we want all of our friends to use Apple products, I don't think we always should tell our friends to use or buy Apple products. So I don't think that's really giving you the ammunition you want, but you know your friend better than I do. And I think it's more important that we get the right technology to people rather than just trying to push them into a certain platform. So that's just how I feel about this sort of stuff. If you have any follow-up questions, if anybody has anything to add or to let JP know about, if you have some ammunition that you've used to convert your friends away from the dark side, then we always like having more people in our community. Send those along, send those tips, send those hints, and I look forward to your emails. Thanks, JP, for the message. Listener Benjamin has a little bit of a problem with his iCloud. He noticed recently that the available storage for his iCloud backups started dwindling really fast, and he really hadn't added any new applications to his iOS devices, and he was monitoring his backups very closely, according to his email, but suddenly he just started having more space eaten up. I think he said he lost over a gigabyte of space in a period of just a couple weeks without really making any significant changes. And he told me that he tried to combat it by doing a restore of his devices and resetting everything back up, but the same amount of storage was used up on iCloud after he did the update. So he really was wanted to know, you know, what's going on here, what's happening, and do we have a solution for him? And so I thought about this a little bit, Benjamin, and, you know, depending on the number of apps that you have being backed up, and the kinds of applications, possibly if you have a lot of games, the issue may simply be that you're running your application updates. And I say that because, you know, ever since the new iPad came out, a lot of developers have been working on and focusing on getting their graphics up to date with Retina. So they're throwing in larger graphics files. And so when they go to push out a new update, I've seen in some cases where application updates could be double in size from what they were originally. So there's no real significant new features or functionality. It's just suddenly the app's gotten bigger because there's bigger graphics assets in there. And so you could go into iTunes and look at the sizes of your individual apps and see what's taking up space. A good indicator too when you're in there is if you look at the other category, that's typically going to be the kind of data and storage that applications are using up. I don't think in your case that it's probably the case, especially if you haven't changed any applications, where applications are suddenly storing more data or using up more space, but you could go into iTunes and look around. A secondary question that Benjamin had related to his apps and data storage was, is there a way to actually clear off just the data information that an individual app might store? So if you go into settings, into general, under usage on your phone, you can look at the different storage options there, and you can see both the app storage, the amount of storage apps are taking up on your device, and you can also see and manage your iCloud storage. That's the kinds of data and stuff that your apps are backing up to iCloud storage. And in the iCloud storage section, you can actually tap Manage Storage, and you can drill down to get to the documents and data for individual apps, and you can actually delete that. You can actually swipe over it and have it deleted or removed from iCloud to free up space on your iCloud account. For individual applications, though, this is the local data that it stores on your device. You can look in that app storage section, and it shows, I think, the 10 apps that are using up the most storage right there at the top of the list. And then down below, it'll have a little show all button. You can tap on that and get a list of all of the applications on your iOS device that are using storage. And you can tap on individual apps to see specifically some details about how much storage it's using up. And for some applications, like the video app or photos or podcasts, you can actually go in and swipe across and delete or remove specific bits of data. Now, be careful doing this because that is going to delete the data from your device. So if you delete all the videos in your video application, you're not going to have any movies on your iOS device again until you go back to your machine and back them up. If you shot video, you have to be really careful with this, because if you've shot a photo or if you shot video on your phone and you haven't synced it back to your computer, you could lose data. So be careful doing that, but you do have the ability to swipe and remove and delete specific bits of data. For other applications, it's usually just the option to view how much storage it's using up, and you could delete the whole entire app, which will also delete the application data that goes along with it, and you can free up space that way, but then you no longer have the app. Of course, you could go back to the App Store and simply reinstall it to get it back on without any local app data being stored. So that's one way to clear it off. It's a little bit cumbersome, but it does work. Last question Benjamin had was about iTunes and no longer being able to automatically download both the HD and SD versions of a TV show. Currently, the process in order to get an SD version of a TV show, I think in iTunes it now defaults to the HD version. If you want to get an SD version after making a purchase, you can go back into the iTunes store. You can go to the purchase tab of your account, And then you can go to the page for the TV show. You can click on the title to go to the show page. You can click over to the SD version of the show from there, and you can re-download the episode in standard definition. That is a big, long process, and Ben was like, is there a way to make that easier or quicker? And I delved into this, and I did not see something that made that easier. And unfortunately, there's no setting in iTunes to force it to only download the SD versions of a show. What you can do is you can set up the preferences to pull down a 720p version of HD rather than 1080p by default. If you go into iTunes preferences, click on the store tab, you'll see an option that says when downloading HD videos, prefer, and there's a setting for 1080p, which I think is the default. There's also a setting for 720p. You might also be able to, though, Ben, save a step or two in the re-download process. I noticed that once you go to the purchase page on the store, if you look down there at the bottom, there is an option that says download HD when available, a little checkbox. And when I unchecked that, I noticed that on the re-download page, it showed just the SD or the standard definition download link. The HD labels actually went away when I unchecked that box. So that may save some steps in the re-download process, or after you've downloaded the HD version, if you go back and uncheck that box, you might be able to click and then download the SD version from that purchase page. But beyond that, I don't think there's any quicker way to get to that SD content than what you're doing already. Let's talk a little bit about iPhones and iPhone cellular coverage and plans, and specifically the sort of high costs of getting on a contract to get a subsidized phone, which is what I think most of us do, a lot of us do, especially in the U.S. I know outside the U.S. it's becoming more and more common, but also outside the U.S. you have generally a lot more access to prepaid plans and unlocked phones and devices. Here in the States, most people I know have on-contract phones that are locked to specific carriers. And I started talking about this a while back when AT&T finally agreed to unlock devices without a lot of hassle, devices that were no longer on contract. I took my iPhone 3GS, I unlocked it, and I played around with some of the prepaid options and plans that we have here in the U.S., and I looked at T-Mobile, and I also looked at a company called Straight Talk. And I think at the end of that whole process, I had mentioned that when the next iPhone came out, which we're literally, you know, very close to right now, that I was seriously going to consider buying a purely unlocked device, paying the price premium, which I think for a 64 gig model is going to run about $850 to get just the phone, but not get it locked to any specific carrier, not on AT&T or Sprint or Verizon, just have an unlocked device and then get one of these Straight Talk SIMs, do a pay-as-you-go plan. And a number of people have asked me to talk a little bit about that and are wondering, am I still going to go forward with that plan of getting an unlocked device? Straight Talk is a bring-your-own-phone program, BYOP, prepaid service. It is sold mostly through Walmart, but they have an online site where you can go and order a SIM card, either a standard SIM or a micro SIM. I don't think they have nano SIMs available, which may be the total deal breaker here. I mean, if the new iPhone only has a nano SIM, I'm probably going to have to get it on one of the big carriers. But Straight Talk is owned by a company called TracFone, and they're pretty well known in the U.S. for doing prepaid plans on sort of feature and less smartphones. And they are a mobile virtual network operator, an MVNO, which means they don't have their own lines. They actually lease time or space, get coverage on AT&T and T-Mobile's GSM and HSPA Plus networks. So they resell that service at a discounted price. And so you purchase the SIM directly from their website. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at mattcast.com. You pop it in your phone, you go through an activation process on their website, and you're up and running. And the positives of using a service like Straight Talk are that, one, you're not on contract, but then the plans, you get a lot more bang for your buck. With Straight Talk, it's $45 a month, and for that, you get unlimited minutes, unlimited voice, text, and data on your device. And you can buy refill cards at Walmart or you can sign up for auto-renewing. So every 30 days, it'll just charge your card another $45, and you have unlimited talk, text, and data. And that's it. It's that straightforward. So it takes some of the complexities out of having a contract as well. And because they use AT&T's network, you get exactly the same coverage that you would if you were on contract with AT&T. It's the same 3G HSPA Plus network, which is what AT&T calls their current 4G. When you have an iPhone 4 or an iPhone 4S, you know, you get the 4G on there. They're saying because HSPA Plus is essentially 4G speeds, that it's a 4G network. So it looks exactly the same, behaves exactly the same, same call quality, same everything when you're using Straight Talk. And the huge benefit is the potential savings when you look at it versus a 2-year contract. So simplifying things down, and this is not how it is in my case, but if you look at buying the phone on contract on AT&T, I'm pricing out the 64 gig model. You're looking at $400 for the phone, $70 a month for the voice plan, $30 a month for the 3 gigabyte 3G data plan, excuse me, and $20 for unlimited texting. That's $120 a month for the 2-year life of the contract, is $3,280 US. On Straight Talk, you'd have to pay more upfront for the phone, $849, but then it's just $45 a month. You get unlimited voice, unlimited text, and unlimited data. We'll talk about the unlimited data here in a minute, but you get all those things for 24 months, and so the total of all of that would be $1,929 for the 2-year contract. And that's a total savings of $1,351. So over the life of that contract, you're saving over $1,300, which is a pretty good deal. When you look at family plans, things get a little bit muddier because you pay a lot more, especially on the voice side, for that first phone. You pay the $70, but then your additional phone for the voice features is only $10. And then you can also do things like you can tier your data. You can get secondary devices with maybe a smaller data plan at a lower rate, or maybe one that doesn't have the texting. So the pricing can change a little bit, and it makes this whole equation a little bit muddier. But in my case, I was kind of doing the math, and if I worked it all out, I end up with about a $415 savings over the 2 years. So definitely not as significant as the $1,300, but still a pretty significant savings. And I end up not being on a contract, and I could go back to a carrier at any time I want. You can also port your number, which is another nice thing. So you can take your number with you and you can move it on to Straight Talk. So it all sounds pretty good, but then you start drilling in even more, and there are a few little downsides. The first and foremost being that setup is a little bit trickier, not difficult by any stretch of the imagination. You have to go in and you have to tweak some settings on your phone. When you put the SIM in, if you're on a purely unlocked device, they have a screen. You can go in and tweak the settings. It's called the APN settings. You have to enter a few numbers going through the website. They give you the information. Not that tricky, but definitely a little bit more technical. Unlimited data. they say it's unlimited data. It's not really unlimited, which again is just the same as you have with AT&T, right? If you're grandfathered in the unlimited plan like I am, you know it's not truly unlimited. When you hit that data cap, when you go over that 2 gigabyte or 3 gigabyte level, they start throttling you on AT&T. Apparently, from what I've been reading with Straight Talk, they will send you an email warning you that you have heavy data usage, and in some cases, it's been reported that people have had their Straight Talk plans canceled. Again, at that point, you could just go back to another carrier. So not that big a hassle, but something definitely to think about when you're considering the plan. Another thing that I've read about and I struggled with when I tried to play with this with my 3GS is that MMS, picture messaging, may or may not work. I found some places online that had a profile that you could install that would get MMS working, but getting it out of the box, just tweaking the APN settings, proved to be a little bit difficult. iMessage fully supports images and does work directly on the Straight Talk device without any tweaking. So depending upon if you're really heavily reliant on MMS, you may or may not want to consider using Straight Talk. The other bigger thing, especially when looking at comparing it to the iPhone 5, is all the rumors are pointing to iPhone 5 supporting LTE. Currently, from all the research I've done, it's not indicating that Straight Talk will support LTE, and I don't know if they ever will, if AT&T will hold that back from them. But again, they're on AT&T's network, so if AT&T has LTE, it may be possible that Straight Talk would also have LTE as long as they have the hardware to support it. And if you're going to buy an unlocked iPhone, obviously your hardware is going to support that technology. But who knows if that will be available. So you might be on the HSPA Plus network, which again, AT&T says runs at 4G speeds. How it's going to actually compare to AT&T's LTE, that's really up in the air. So those are some of the downsides. There's also some things, like I said, that complicate my choice personally to switch to Straight Talk, and I'm still debating these things. One is that I do have one phone that's still under contract, so I can't get that off contract and move it to Straight Talk without paying early termination fees. I've done the ETF math. It's about $215 for me to cancel, so you weigh that into the fact that I'm going to save $415 over 2 years, I'm ending up with a net $200 savings for buying an unlocked phone and moving off AT&T. So it makes my decision a little bit more difficult because really ultimately I'm not getting a lot on the savings side in terms of an advantage. What I am getting as a huge advantage though is not being on a contract anymore and having the flexibility to choose my plans and to change things. So that still might be enough incentive for me to go with a purely unlocked phone. The other thing, like I said, is they don't have family plans, so you have to pay full price. If you want a second phone, it's another $45 for the Straight Talk plan. You get all of the advantages, unlimited text, unlimited voice, and unlimited data on every device, but you have to, again, pay for it. There's no tiers, no data tiers, no options. And if you're buying a new phone every year, if you plan on buying a new phone every year, which I have been doing, then again, the price advantages go way down because you're going to have to buy an unlocked device every year. And at $849 each year, that gets pretty expensive. So all that factoring in, what am I going to do? I still really don't know. The honest answer is I have a couple weeks to probably figure it out. The more and more I look at all of my factors weighing in, I may just end up with a subsidized device on Verizon. I do think I'm going to move away from AT&T because I'm really getting tired of the data caps. I'm getting tired of the fact that they don't give you the free tethering like Verizon does. I also am hearing things that, you know, Verizon's 4G network is vastly superior, or LTE network, I should say, is vastly superior to AT&T's. Verizon's coverage has always been better in the U.S. So if I do end up going with a subsidized phone, I think it's going to be a Verizon version, and I may even still pay the ETF fee to move my one device that's still under contract over to Verizon just so that I have everything on the same network. But I don't know what I'm going to do. If you have opinions, if you've looked into this as well, let us all know. Share with us what you're thinking about doing, because I'm still kind of on the fence. It's really tempting to have an unlocked device, but if I can't get LTE support and I'm only saving a couple hundred bucks over 2 years, I don't know that it ends up really being worth it. We'll see. And I'm going to end today's show with a fun, challenging email that I received. I love it when you send me these questions that really get me thinking about solutions, stuff that I hadn't thought about. And this one came from Ken. He wanted to know about how he could go about recording the game sounds from Angry Birds on his iOS device. I think he said his son or somebody in his family really liked Angry Birds, and he wanted to kind of extract some of the songs so that he could play them and, you know, have them on his device just as music files. And, you know, he suggested to me, well, you know, I could just take a cable, an 1/8-inch audio cable, and run it from my iOS device, the headphone jack on my iOS device, and put it to my Mac. What would you recommend for recording that audio? And that one's pretty straightforward and easy. It's, you know, record it with GarageBand. You have that built into your Mac. You can just plug that 1/8-inch jack into the audio in on your Mac, go into the system sound preferences, and change your input to be the audio input coming from the iOS device, and then set that up in GarageBand and hit record and record whatever audio off your iOS device that you want. Pretty straightforward. That's kind of the analog hole. If you wanted to get really ghetto about it. You could literally use the built-in mic on your Mac and the built-in speaker on your iOS device, hold one next to the other, and also use GarageBand or any other kind of simple recording app on the Mac to actually capture that audio. Obviously, the quality is not going to be as great, but it would get the job done. And so after that, I started thinking about this question, thought there's probably some better ways that we can do this, and we can probably get a better audio file, better quality, and keep it purely digital. And Ken, I'm going to go out on a limb and assume that your Mac and your iPad are on the same Wi-Fi network. But if you have that scenario going on, then what I would do is go to Rogue Amoeba at rogueamoeba.com and then go into their Airfoil section. They have a great application called Airfoil that lets you take the audio from your Mac and send it over AirPlay to a set of AirPlay speakers or to your Apple TV, something like that. It can also do a bunch of other stuff, but that's the core concept behind it. Great piece of software. I absolutely love it and recommend it. But as part of that, what they have is they have different outputs that you can look into, and they actually have a piece of software. So if you go in the Airfoil section and click on the compatible outputs section, you'll find that they have an application called Airfoil Speakers. And if you download that application, what that allows you to do is set up any Mac or PC as an audio destination for Airfoil, or for, more importantly in this case, for AirPlay audio. So download that free application, install it on your Mac, and then still on the Rogue Amoeba site, go over and get a copy of Piezo, which is an app. It's $14.99 US. You can get it directly from the Rogue Amoeba website, or you can get it through the Mac App Store. And it is a recording application. It will let you record audio from any application on your Mac. Now, you could also use Audio Hijack Pro, another great application from Rogue Amoeba, but Piezo is a brand new one. It kind of simplifies the process, and it's just for recording the audio from applications. Audio Hijack Pro goes way beyond, has a lot more features and functionality, so if you need that stuff and can take advantage of it, you might want to look into that. But Piezo is, I think, the easiest one to get to use for this application. And so you launch Piezo, and then from the source options, you'll choose Other Application. And then you're going to pick the Airfoil Speakers application. And that should launch the Airfoil Speakers app and then start capturing, or set it up to capture the audio that's coming through Airfoil Speakers. And so you may have figured out where this is going. After that, go over to the iPad, launch Angry Birds, and then double tap on the home button to bring up the app switcher, and then swipe from left to right and move over to the place where you see the audio controls and click on the AirPlay button, or tap on the AirPlay button, and you should then see your Mac as an AirPlay audio destination. Those Airfoil speakers are now an audio destination that you can send the audio from your iPad to your Mac. And so select that, and after a second or two, you should hear the iPad audio, the Angry Birds audio, on your Mac. If not, make sure you know your volume's turned up and that you can hear it. But then in Piezo, all you have to do is tap the record button, because Piezo is already watching and keeping track of the audio coming in through the Airfoil Speakers application and will now record it. So you can hit record, start recording any audio that's being broadcast over AirPlay audio from your iOS device to your Mac. And then when you're done, tap the record button again. That will finish your recording, and you should now have an AAC audio recording of Angry Birds on your Mac. So I thought of that solution and thought, hey, I'm pretty smart. I figured that out. That's a pretty good one, right? And then I realized, you know what? There's an even better way of doing this that's even more direct, and you don't have to do the work of actually recording the audio yourself. And what you can do is you can extract the audio files directly from the Angry Birds app on your Mac. If you go to the Finder and go into your home folder in the music folder, inside iTunes, inside the iTunes media folder, inside the mobile applications folder, you will see all of your apps. And if you've moved your iTunes music folder someplace else, you'll need to go there. But wherever your iTunes music folder is, go in there and find the mobile applications folder. And inside there, you're going to find all of your apps. And you're going to look, in this case, for the angrybirds.ipa file. And when you've located that, we're going to be messing with it, so you're going to want to make a copy. I would go ahead and select the file and make a copy of it onto your desktop. Or a quicker way to do that is just hold down the Option key, drag it from the iTunes folder to your desktop. You'll notice you'll have the little plus icon that'll make a copy of it right onto your desktop. And then once you have the copy, go to the copy of it and rename the angrybirds.ipa file to angrybirds.zip. A lot of people don't know that the IPA files are really just zip files, compressed files, and it's probably going to prompt you to confirm that you want to change the extension. Go ahead and click OK. You may even need to enter your admin password. I don't remember if you need to do that or not, but once you have it renamed as a .zip file, go ahead and double-click on it, and it should open up and extract it, and you'll end up with an Angry Birds folder on your desktop. Go into that folder, and then inside there, you'll find a payload folder, and then inside that, you should see an angrybirds.app file. Control-click or right-click on that file, and choose Show Package Contents. So just like the applications on your Mac, that application is actually a package, and you can look inside there. Inside the package contents, when that opens up in the Finder, you'll see a folder called data underscore iPhone or data underscore iPad. I was looking at the iPhone file for Angry Birds, so it was data underscore iPhone. Regardless, find that folder, and inside there, you should see an audio folder, and inside that, you should see a music folder, and guess what's inside there? All of the MP3 files for the game, and you could literally just copy those out of there. Interestingly, there's also a sound effects folder. You're going to find a bunch of other assets in there. There's graphics images, there's icons, there's all kinds of goodies inside these applications that you can actually get at directly on your Mac if you just know how to look for it. So I would do that. Grab the MP3 files, find the ones that you want, copy them to your Mac, and you're done. You've got them extracted right out of the application itself, the original files. So that, I think, is the best way to go about it. I'll give you one last one because this one's a quickie. If you want to also capture video, I've talked about, I think on the last episode, the Reflection app, reflectionapp.com. This lets you use the AirPlay mirroring technology to send video or send your mirror your screen from your iOS device right onto your Mac. And within that application, it has a record button. So you can actually record that audio and video, and then you could open that up in QuickTime and then use the QuickTime export option to export the audio only and get an audio file out that way, along with a video file if you want to have the video files. So have I presented enough options? I'm sure some of you are like, hey, I know another way you can do that. That's what's awesome about this stuff is there's a million answers to different questions. Not always, but a lot of times there's multiple ways to do this stuff. And it just depends on, I guess the fun is in the journey. Is that what they say? I don't know. Don't look to me for your philosophy, your ancient religions, whatever. All right. I think that's going to do it for this episode. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software, get more information and details, as well as a trial over at circusponies.com. Smile, check out Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, PDF Pen for iPad, or Text Expander Touch. You can get information on all their great software, as well as free trials of their Mac applications over at smilesoftware.com. SquareTrade, you know, if you're going to get a new iPhone and you want to protect it from drops and liquid damage and have a warranty that's going to cover you for those oops moments, you should check out SquareTrade. That's at squaretrade.com/maccast. And Gazelle, you know, if you want to get some cash to use to buy that new iPhone, Gazelle is a great place to do that. You can get more information and get an offer over at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. I love hearing your questions, your topics, your suggestions, just in general chatting with you. If you want to send an email, send it to maccast@gmail.com or call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave voicemail there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. The Skype address is the MacCast. And be sure to check out the website. There you'll find show notes with links to everything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast. That's at maccast.com. Check out the forum while you're there. Great online community of Mac geeks hanging out there. You can get your questions answered there also. Sometimes turning to the community is an even better option. That's at forum.maccast.com. It's free to sign up and participate and hang out, so I encourage you to do that. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, and be sure to check out the Facebook page. That's over at facebook.com/themaccast. That's going to do it for now. I'll talk to you in a couple days all about that new iPhone. I'm super excited. I can't wait. That's going to be a fun day tomorrow. All right. I'll catch you post keynote, and until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.